This series of Let's Make It Rain is sponsored by PensionBee, a leading online pension provider. They're on a mission to make pensions simple so that customers all over the UK can become pension confident and save for a happy retirement. PensionBee's website and app make it simple for customers to combine their old pension pots, contribute flexibly, and withdraw their pension money all in one place. PensionBee offers a range of pension plans for different savings needs, from a flexible self-employed plan to socially responsible plans like their Impact Plan or Sharia Compliant Plan. Head to pensionbee.com or download the app to get started and become pension confident. Remember, when investing, your capital is at risk. And speaking of investing, you've probably heard me say before that we are our own biggest asset by far, and that includes investing in the next generation. I wrote Cash's Queen exclusively for preteen and teenage girls to equip them with everything they need to take control of their financial futures early. It's been translated into 5 languages and is available worldwide. So grab a copy for you and a friend today. Hi, and welcome to the Let's Make It Rain podcast. I'm your host, Davinia Tomlinson. This podcast is for the rainmakers. Those women who are breaking down walls, building their own empires, defying convention and rejecting stereotypes. Women who are unafraid to have open, honest conversations about money among friends and to share the truths we've been told to keep secret. Don't forget to subscribe, share and download wherever you usually get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, then please leave us a 5-star review. Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Let's Make It Rain podcast. Today, I'm pleased to be joined by Crystal McGilvery. Crystal is a chartered accountant, money coach, business mentor and founder of Mind Over Money. Crystal, thank you so much for being here today. Why don't you introduce yourself for the benefit of the listeners?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to have this chat. that's me. Chartered accountant, been in the finance space for soon approaching 20 years. Now I run my own company, Mind Over Money, and my thing is all about financial empathy, incorporating behavioral science, psychology, to get people to be better with their money, build their business, and fairer, more comfortable financial world.
I love that. And I particularly love the way you positioned it as someone that's in the business of helping to unlock financial empathy. I love that as a concept. Can you share with us a bit more about what that means?
Yeah, for sure. I think it's funny. There's an article on my website that has had the most hits month after month since it's gone live. And it's all about how to help others with financial empathy. So when we think about, as you know, the world of finance, money is full of taboo. People are afraid to talk about it. How much do you have? Comparison, social status. And that's quite a hard and aggressive approach to money. With financial empathy, we're taking our time to be gentle with ourselves and with others as well. So it's being gentle with ourselves to understand where we are, understand where we want to get to, and be honest about our shortcomings and actually not blaming ourselves. You know, you've heard the phrase, I'm just rubbish at money or whatever. And actually it's turning that on its head and giving a really good rationale as to why that is wrong. And actually you're just fine. So yeah, coming from that angle basically of gentleness and then giving people the confidence.
Yeah. And you know, I think for me, when we consider how much of the conversation and discourse around money is riddled with guilt and shame and then shrouded in secrecy, the idea of financial empathy feels like a really nice, gentle way for people to take a step back and notice, just observe objectively some of the things that they're doing, some of the ways they might improve, and then to observe others without projecting their own perhaps shortcomings, their own ambitions or expectations around money onto other people. And this is what one of the reasons why I often say to the rainmakers, you know, the women that I'm privileged to get to work with, that it's so important that we run our own races and that we are clear on our own path to success and what our financial health means to us, so that we can make sure that when we are trying to build this sustainable long-term wealth, which, you know, we also want to normalize some of the vocabulary around money and remind women that it's okay for us to want to be wealthy in all of the different ways that manifests itself, but that our version of wealth might look different from someone else's. And so financial empathy just feels like a beautiful way to encapsulate all of those things. So thank you for sharing that. And so at the end and in the show notes, I will put links to your website so people can go and check out that article. But Crystal, at the time of recording, it's Mental Health Week. And of course, given the kind of work that we both do, it would be impossible really to overstate the relationship between money and mental health. What would you say are some of the less common signs you observe in your client base? So I think most of us, people listening and others, will be able to attest to some of the more obvious signs of poor financial well-being. It could be those people that we know that are worried about debt, they're worried about paying a bill, for example, things like that. But are there certain things that actually might exist within us? You know, I read an article that talked about how many of us basically are moving through the world in a constant low level of anxiety, and we've just normalized that low level of anxiety that hums along in the background. But what would you say are some of the less common signs you observe in your client base that indicate financially related poor mental well-being?
Yeah, it's such an interesting question. Just touch on your comment there about the constant state of anxiety. I think that's so, yeah, it's such a thing. I mean, I'm open about the fact that I've had therapy and I think I will for the rest of my life because it's transformational. Just, I think everyone should explore that. And when you work with someone who helps you see that this tension you have in the body, the stress you're exhibiting, and you don't, and lots of people don't even realize it, that actually you are stressed. And it seems like it's your day-to-day, this is just what I do, this is just how I do it. For example, overworking, simple as, you say you do run your own business, or say you have a 9-to-5 and you pick up a side hustle, or you're always trying to make an extra buck because you're so stressed about not having enough. That directly is a consequence of having maybe a negative relationship with money, not understanding how money works economically and how, you know, you can take advantage of things such as leverage or whatever it may be. You're just getting yourself into a state of constantly working, worried that you're not going to have enough is one that I think people may not associate with. Actually, there's a problem here around my finances.
That's such a brilliant example. And you'll be familiar with this concept, the money script, which is a brilliant body of research, a study done by two Stanford academics. And we talk about it. We talk about the psychology of money in the Rainmakers Academy. But the thing that's very interesting about that is that we, as a society, I would suggest, automatically associate poor financial health with those people at the lower end of the income spectrum. So you assume that those people that are earning less by default must be more stressed about money, have an inability to manage money, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the things that was very interesting for me about the money scripts is that there are those people as a result of, and of course there are a number of different contributory factors, but one of the drivers for the money scripts that you might find yourself at, and there are four categories. So you've got money worship, money status, money avoidance, and money vigilance for anybody that's interested in those different categories. And you can straddle more than one, obviously. And of course, those money scripts will change over the course of your life. But I think one of the defining characteristics of money worship or money status, so money status is that you associate your sense of self-worth with your financial worth. And then money worship in that you are constantly pursuing wealth. You know, you'll never have enough. And so you're effectively running yourself into the ground. You're going to push yourself off a cliff for the pursuit of wealth because you feel that, you know, and it's not even so much that you feel that, you know, the more money you've got in the bank, the better you'll feel about yourself. It's just that you are constantly stressed and worried that you're going to run out of money. And so even if you've got millions, it never quite feels like enough, which I guess is exactly what you were describing there, Crystal.
Yeah, precisely. And I'm glad you raised that point, because I think the common narrative is that people who have money problems don't have much money. And that's not the case at all. If anything, and you know, with me and my money coaching, the majority of my clients are high earners. There's hardly any who are low earners and don't have enough money coming in. It's more the relationship to money, which impacts what they do with their money day to day, which then impacts the state of their wealth, their day to day running of their finances. So yeah, spot on with, I think that's a really good point to raise. And again, just back to people, you know, looking at themselves and their own finances and realizing that actually it's got nothing to do with how good you are at money or how much money you have. There's actually other things going on there.
Yeah. And it, again, it's back to this principle of financial empathy, which, yeah, that's going to stay with me long after this episode has finished recording, Crystal, for real. So I guess just touching on then, because, you know, though this idea of the money script is a good anchor for this next question around the ways that we might be influenced by what we observe externally. So all of those extrinsic factors that can motivate us to take decisions that we wouldn't otherwise take. And we see this most acutely when it comes to our money. So, you know, when we think about the ways that social media might amplify perhaps feelings of inadequacy that all of us, I'm sure, possess to various degrees. And I guess we all exist on a continuum in terms of how much we are impacted by other people's lifestyles in terms of the decisions that we might take. What would you say are some of the financial dangers, though, for us in comparing ourselves with others? And how can we manage that risk? How can we manage that exposure? I mean, this is something that I'm particularly interested in because, of course, having written Cash is Queen, one of the areas that I was most concerned about getting right was the chapter on social media, the dangers of social media, particularly for that age group, preteen and teenage girls. And it's not just girls, but, you know, young people in general that are a TikTok generation, they're on social media all the time and are therefore exposed to all sorts of messages, a bombardment of different messages, different stimuli. And they have no way of being able to filter millions of different people in this FinTok crew talking to them about how they can acquire material gains, material possessions, and also build wealth, whether, you know, that information they're receiving is legit, whether it's completely dodgy, and what they should be looking for. What are some of the hallmarks of really sound, relatable, and trustworthy guidance around their finances? But it's not just young people. And I think, you know, I always stress this with the people that I come into contact with, particularly those that try to bash young people and deride them for being on social media. I think we, you know, millennials are probably, we had first mover advantage, didn't we, in terms of being on, you know, the first people to be using social media to the extent that we, because, you know, we were the first people off the track straight out of the gate when it was first launched. And so I don't think we are immune to those dangers either. So what would you say to those people that are on Instagram or what have you, watching their favorite influencer and thinking, I feel now that I failed because I'm nowhere near that level of attainment. I haven't got a book deal. I haven't moved to a house in the country. I'm not getting these paid for holidays that look beautiful and glamorous, you know, and therefore I'm failing at life.
Yeah, it's such an important topic. And I was just on a podcast the other day talking about this as well. So I think the biggest danger, the scariest part about social media and seeing these flashy, amazing looking people with their amazing looking lives, is the social comparison, right? If we think back to pre-social media, when we didn't have such easy access to people around the world in such different circumstances, different backgrounds, different upbringings, different, you know, GDP, etc., you weren't comparing what you saw as like for like. So they're my age. Okay, I should be like them. And that's what I think is happening. Whereas actually there's so many other factors that go into what someone's life is like, on top of the fact that what people present on social media is not reality. That's not their day to day. And I'm sure you can relate or you are aware as well, but there are so many people out there who look like they're doing fantastically, but if you know them personally, they are really struggling with their mental health. I know some really outwardly successful finfluencers or just influence in general with, you know, 50, 60, 100, 200, 500K followers that are really struggling day to day. And that's not coming through. So when you've got the general consumer person scrolling through Instagram or whatever and thinking, oh, I haven't got that, that's really damaging. And that then creates this idea that, okay, I have to do things in my life, even though my circumstances are really different, but that's not brought into the thought process to then have that lifestyle. So gather all the money I can to go to Dubai and live that lavish life, or buy the Tesla or whatever car it is. And then it, obviously, when we're talking about wealth, it becomes really unsustainable. Whether that's your day-to-day expenses, you know, you're barely getting by, you're not thinking about the future, you're not thinking about, you know, your next step in your career, you're not focused on the right things. And then, of course, when we link it back to mental health, well, for sure, because it's not sustainable, you're then putting yourself in a really negative position and likely to struggle. Yeah, it's really unfortunate because that's what I see that is happening. It's just really unrealistic. And I think people are thinking it is realistic and then they're trying to do the same thing.
It's this feeling of kind of straddling a digital and an analog world. And then creating, you know, there's this mental chaos that's created in both. And, you know, again, this idea of that money status, you know, feeling like I've got to keep up, otherwise I'm failing. You know, I don't want to be viewed as behind. And exactly as you say, it's these really arbitrary indicators or benchmarks. So it could be age. It could be we're from the same area. It could be we're from the same background where we work in the same career. You know, how has she managed to get there and I haven't? And everyone's journey looks so different. You know, what we see is surface level. We have no understanding of or insight into what the reality is. The difficulty, though, is that, you know, when we hear people say things like, we need to do a digital detox, you need to just come off social media, delete your accounts. And of course, that can be really good and practical advice. Maybe do, you know, make a mental note or a physical note even to curate who you're following. Curate that list so that you are exposed to things that are feeding and nourishing your mind. If you know that actually this is my daily or my nightly wind down, it could be, right, instead of you just idly scrolling endlessly, set an alarm and say, right, I'm going to do it for 10 or 15 minutes. And then after that, I'm going to sleep or I'm going to carry on with the rest of my day. But know that this is your, and we don't even need to badge it as a guilty pleasure. Just badge it as this is something that I want to do, but it's taking up too much of my time. So I'm going to reduce that time. I'm also going to minimize my exposure to the people that I know are triggering. And, you know, you can start to feel certain things physiologically. You know, when I come off Instagram, for example, and I've been looking at certain accounts, is my heart racing? Does my head start spinning? Do I feel completely discombobulated? You know, how do I feel internally and kind of sit with it and notice how you're feeling? So it really does require us to pay attention to some of the clues because our body will always tell us. It's like that brilliant book. And I refer to this all the time, you know, your body keeps the score. And so your body is telling you all the time what's going on with you. And it's up to us to decide whether or not we're going to continue to suppress those indicators or whether we're going to pay attention to them and start to take action. And I really feel like that's the first step along many others. But you were quite right. I mean, you touched on therapy and there are so many different types of therapy. Talking therapy may not necessarily be appropriate for everyone, but there are other forms. And I think that might be a way for people to start to uncover some of the other things that might be going on with them as well.
Yeah. And just a couple of things I want to touch on there. Yeah, because for sure, I totally agree. And I do it myself. And I think so two things I really wanted to touch on. One is the whole curating your feed, which on the surface sounds like unfollow people, right? And if you are not yet bold enough to say, I'm going to unfollow you because of what that might mean in terms of the conversation later. On things like Instagram, you can mute somebody. So you can actually stop them appearing in your feed without having to actually unfollow them, which is a beautiful feature, you know, if you're not quite ready to do it officially. And then also, again, what I do on my phone, it automatically turns off at a certain time. I think it's 11 o'clock, my phone turns off. So assuming that I get to bed by 10:30.
Me too, Crystal.
Right? My phone then goes gray. And it's like, if I'm going to turn it back on, I'm intentionally, like it's something we call frictions in behavioral economics. You're creating frictions to make it harder for you to do the unwanted behavior. So the unwanted behavior here is scrolling on Instagram, Facebook, whatever your thing is, TikTok. So you're creating that extra layer, extra effort. So here it's my phone is going to turn off completely. And the only thing that's going to be able I can use is check my clock. So as an alternative, you know, to help you because yeah, setting a timer for how long you're going to be on Instagram, it's still quite hard because of what happens to your brain, the dopamine, you're just scrolling video and video and before you know it, an hour is gone. You're not really aware of the time. You're time blind in that moment. But yeah, the book, The Body Keeps Score is absolutely phenomenal. I'm almost done with it now. So if anyone's not read it, that's what I was going to say. Just back to the therapy piece. So I'm a CBT coach as well, and I incorporate CBT into my money coaching because it's really transformational. So for people who've never really reflected on the way they think and are not overly self-aware and understand how much that directly impacts what they are doing, it's really helpful to get you to question and reframe how you view things and then make the changes in your life to then go about improving your finances. So yeah, therapy, so many ways to go about it. And CBT is one of the easier to access methods.
I'm so glad you came back to that because you talked about friction. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, for people that come from a background in which they're constantly seeking ways to eliminate friction from processes. You know, if you come from the corporate world, you're constantly thinking about how to minimize costs, maximize profit, all these sorts of things. And that requires you to remove as much friction as you possibly can. And those principles can apply to every aspect of our lives. You know, I talk about running your life like a business when it comes to managing your money. And that, again, comes back to this idea of eliminating friction. What can you automate? How can you make sure that you are scheduling regular money dates with yourself? We're not leaving anything to chance. We're not going to be passive about money. We want to be able and liberated in living our lives completely carefree. But in order to do that, we've got to have a system and a process that's running behind the scenes, your personal money algorithm, if you like, for how your personal finances are managed, that can then facilitate you in doing things that you want to do. And I think this is an area that fascinates me with regard to the ways that we trip ourselves up by not necessarily putting the systems in place that we need to, because we think, oh, it's going to take too long, or I haven't got time to do that. And so instead, we spend twice as long doing a task that a system or a bit of automation could do for us in a fraction of the time. And that really speaks to our decision-making, the things that drive our decision-making, our personal psychology. And of course, this chimes so well with everything that we talk about with regard to money mindset, because again, there are certain trending catchphrases, aren't there? You know, work on your money mindset, or talking about securing the bag, or money affirmations. And of course, we at Raincheck are always talking about money affirmations. We're always trying to remind women to remain attuned to the things that we tell ourselves, the stories that we tell ourselves, the lies quite often about our ability to manage money, our capability, because we know that women are very capable when it comes to managing money. But the stories that we tell ourselves versus the reality, you see this dystopia in how we position it. And I know, Crystal, that you not only have the professional experience in this capacity, but also the academic credentials as well, because you completed a master's in the psychology of decision making. You've talked about being a CBT coach. And we know that, you know, people in general, but women especially, there are multi-layered processes that we go through when it comes to our decision making around money. You know, we're thinking often not just of ourselves, but of others. We're quite often thinking several generations later instead of what's happening in the here and now. And I think there is room for us to do both. But what do you think drives us when it comes to our financial decisions? What prompts us to take action? And what can make us freeze and do nothing? Because I know that one of the biggest challenges for lots of us, but especially women, is knowing that we want to do something, knowing that we need to do something, saying that we're going to do something, and then not doing it. What is stopping us from doing it, even though we've got every possible thing we might need to do it?
Oh, it's such a big question. And I mean, the first disclaimer would be there's not one answer, right? Back to what we just spoke about with money scripts, our upbringing, our experiences, they beautifully come together to create you as a unique individual. And what motivates you or is your driving force to get you to act or not act, it's completely different. But some of the main ones I think will be interesting to touch on here might be, if we think about the world of finance as a woman in this world, finance historically has been focused on men, right? And I know I was recently on BNY Mellon podcast with Albright, and we were talking about pension and investing and, you know, what's happening in the space of women, why they're not. And if you think about the way that investing is advertised, it's for men. And actually, even when they surveyed the investment managers, they see their clients as being mainly men. So they are putting out communication for men. So, you know, I think the initial narrative is, oh, women don't really care about money or whatever this annoying narrative is. And actually, no, on the other side, you've got people not talking to them, which would make you not want to pursue that route, right? You know, as one example, we already spoke about social comparison. I think, you know, we spoke before about motherhood or, you know, just fitting in terms about, you know, back to social comparison, just you doing good enough and feeling like your financial life is where you want it to be and your perception of failure and success. What does that look like? Those factors completely drive what you do with your finances. And if we kind of go back to the more behavioral science, psychology stuff, when we're thinking about prompting us to act, You know, we've got, and I think you, I assume you most probably talk about this with your community, but things like present bias, right? If we know that we're going to be rewarded immediately, we're going to feel the benefits sooner rather than later, it's going to be easier for us to take action. This is, you know, going back to how we inspire people to do the right thing with their finances, whatever the right thing is for them. You know, it's about being smart and twisting and bending whatever it is you need to do so that you take action now. So whether that's, you know, when we think about habit formation, rewarding yourself in the now for making the decision, which will ideally benefit you in the long term as well, we are motivated by present bias. So we're more likely to put money away for a holiday this year than invest for retirement. It's something called temporal distance. So you've got physical distance, which is obviously between me and the wall, you know, or me and the next building. It's a quite obvious distance, but temporal distance is about time. And that's where present bias comes into it, because it's easier for us to imagine the holiday next week than it is for us to imagine ourselves at 70 years old, not having a job and having to rely on the money we've put in the bank. So it's understanding that when it comes to us creating our financial world and how we're going to make that easier. And then other things around prompting us to take action, like you said, affirmations along the lines of, you know, goals and visualization. And I think for some, this is all a bit woo-woo, but it's been proven to work. Again, back to this temporal distance. If we can imagine ourselves with whatever it is we're trying to achieve, you know, whether it's buy the first property, and we can embody that experience, that feeling, it becomes more realistic. And that allows us to be more connected to what we're trying to achieve. So what we need to do right now becomes easier. If we can't really imagine it, we don't really understand, there's too much uncertainty, we're going to dismiss it because our brain likes ease. So when it comes to you trying to create some kind of financial change, you need to make it easy for yourself in whatever way that, you know, you need to do it for yourself. And yeah, that's a couple of stuff. I think I'll stop there because I could carry on for hours.
I think the idea of the thing that, I mean, one of the things that you said that really resonated with me was around gratification. And again, something that I, when I talk to young people in Cash is Queen, when I go into schools, just in general, helping them to understand the difference between immediate and deferred gratification at an early age, and when each of them might kick in, and why immediate gratification actually isn't a bad thing. You know, I think we are socialized and we always try to pin on young people that they can't wait. We want to remind them to wait for later or to save their money for greater reward. But actually, there are also merits in having those kind of pops of joy on a day-to-day basis. But I think it also applies to us as adults. And again, in this age in which we live, where we become so addicted to the immediacy of things. And so you have these massive highs and crashing lows. So where previously we would have been, you know, those highs and lows would have been much more spread out. I can't imagine how many crashing highs and lows you've got in a single day. You know, you're constantly ordering things. The things arrive. Maybe they fit, maybe they don't fit. You wear the outfit, you abandon the outfit, and then you're on to the next thing. And of course, that's just one small example of many different decision points that we might take. But the same principle, you know, is just on in perpetuity as we, you know, become so addicted to those dopamine highs. So yeah, I can really see how when it comes to our decision-making, the things that we are influenced by and the things that drive us are evolving all of the time. And as you rightly say, different people will be motivated and influenced by different things. But it's just such a fascinating area. And I think for anybody to trivialize the impact that being able to manage your money effectively can have on your overall psychology, your mental well-being, your emotional well-being, how you feel about yourself, it would really be a mistake. So I think, you know, if anyone takes away anything from this podcast at all, then I would like them to really reflect on some of the decisions that they're taking and how they are taking decisions around money, what's influencing them, who is influencing them as well, because we know the people around us account for so much of the action that we take, and use that as a start point if you're wanting to transform how you approach your relationship with money and how you are managing your money. Start by looking at the decisions that you are already taking, because there is already so much MI or management information that we're already generating every single day. We've just got to notice it and keep track and then look for patterns or clues in our own behavior.
I just want to add in something there, actually. I can't remember what you said, but it just made me think of this, and I thought this might be interesting for some. So I think in terms of thinking about financial empathy and being gentle with ourselves, we have to be realistic about the world we live in. And like we said earlier on, our phones are built and set up for us to be addicted, right? Our social media platforms, just our phones itself. So we are now living in a world, and we're, like you said earlier, we are stimulated so much more. And it's so much harder for us to go back to how we were, read a book, read a newspaper, go to, you know, that's not our world anymore. And there's something called neuroplasticity, which is about our brains making those connections and basically constantly evolving and building new routes and learning new things and being able to do new things. But that also applies to dopamine, being stimulated. So if our brains are becoming more used to such high stimuli, then that's how we're going to operate. And just linking back to how you ended that section there, the first step is, you're spot on, it's noticing. And that's the whole self-awareness piece. Okay, what is it I'm doing? When am I getting really excited? When am I impulse spending? When are all these things happening for me? Okay, let me reverse engineer so I can create the world, the life, the daily habits that are going to allow me to achieve that goal. And there's no shame in, okay, oh my gosh, this is what I do every such and such. No, it's, you've taken the steps to become aware of it and then make the change necessary, and then you're winning straight away. But I just wanted to touch on that neuroplasticity piece and the fact that the way our world and our technology is set up, it is a bit harder. We are stimulated so much more. So more of us are finding ourselves doing things that are like, oh, I don't want to do that, but I did.
No, thank you for raising that. It's such an important point. And I think that brings me nicely onto my next point around neurodivergence, because I think, you know, there's been growing research, growing focus on this particular area. And I've seen a number of reports and studies. I don't have any data. The Rainmakers know I love data, that suggests that women are the fastest growing group of people to be diagnosed as neurodivergent. Can you define for us, for anybody listening that is unfamiliar with that term, or perhaps has heard it and is just thinking, no idea what that means, what we mean by neurodivergence, and maybe give us some examples of how this shows up for us in our money management? So I suppose I caveat that by saying that this is not an invitation to the Rainmakers or anyone listening to try and self-diagnose with some of these different conditions, because I think it does require, that's one of the dangers, again, that I see with this area, that there is a risk that people begin to self-diagnose without having the proper professional guidance around it. But I do think it's important that we are aware of it in case we are noticing things about ourselves that we think, oh, that seems different, no better or worse, to the way that other people might do it. And I just want to understand why. So can you just, you know, explain for us what it means and then how it might show up for us in our money management?
Yeah, for sure. You know, this is the area that I talk about day in, day out. I'm a lovely neurospicy, as they call it, on the ground. So neurodiversity is basically about the differences in our cognitive functioning. So it's how our brains are all uniquely wired. And there are some different brain wirings that allow us to be diagnosed by the DSM, which is a tool used by, like you said, the assessors, to identify specific traits in the way that you do things, think, feel, and act. For example, many have heard of autism, ADHD, dyslexia. Less commonly spoken about, we've got things like Tourette's or dyspraxia. And all of this is all to do with the way your brain is wired. And like you said, there's nothing wrong. It's more different. And I talk about it a lot when it comes to finance. One, because I noticed differences through my upbringing, through my education, through my employment. And I had no idea why. I just assumed, you know, as I was called, I was an enigma, sure. And I was diagnosed when I did my master's. So, and then I went forward to look around at the space of money and how it interacts with money. And I realized that the majority of my clients, largely who are creative and service-based, were also neurodiverse in some capacity. And it was like, that makes complete sense. And in terms of how it impacts your finances, and again, back to just touching your point there, for sure, you may exhibit some of these traits. You may struggle with your finances in these ways, but it doesn't mean you are neurodiverse. But yeah, it's interesting if you're really struggling with some of this stuff and you can't see a way out to explore it. If you are open to getting support with specifically that. For example, what should we focus on? ADHD, I think, is the one that's really popular right now on socials. And just back to your point about women being diagnosed much more. And I think that's, just given my quick opinion, I think that's largely because we're getting more comfortable talking about this stuff, talking about mental health and neurodivergence. And that is creating a safer space for people to explore it and go and seek help. And typically, historically, young white boys have been diagnosed because they are the hyperactive type. So they're very excited and they get the attention for diagnosis, whereas women tend to be the more quiet and withdrawn type. So yeah, that's increasing because we're talking about it more. So women are going out and actually getting the support they need. But yeah, when we're thinking about our money, if we touch on ADHD, for example, you know, we've got things like forgetfulness, and that might lead to having your subscriptions go out the following month and you intended on cancelling them and you forgot, or forgetting to pay your bills. Monzo Bank did a study specifically on ADHD, and they suggested that it costs, and I think it was ADHD specifically, £1,600 more per year because of having ADHD. A lot of the ADHD community were like laughing because it's likely so much more. And I can concur with that. I think that's actually correct. But yeah, forgetfulness, disorganization. So we think about losing bank cards, losing important documentation. If I vulnerably confess, I used to lose my First Direct bank card every 3 months, which I laugh now because it's funny. I'm okay with it. If we think about kind of linking back to the stuff we spoke about earlier around forward planning. So for many neurodiverse individuals, you are very much driven by dopamine. So you're very much, okay, impulse spending. I want to feel good right now. And you're less likely to plan and do a forecast for your finances or think about where you're trying to get to or think about saving to buy the house. Actually, you're very focused on the now. And another area which I think a lot of people are not talking about when it comes to this space, which I think is really important, is emotional dysregulation, where you are emotionally sensitive or rejection sensitivity. For example, I talk about this a lot when it comes to business. If you need to, I don't know, request funding or go for pitching, and you're afraid of being told no because you're more emotionally sensitive, it's going to impact your business. Also with, for example, going to get sales. If you're afraid about being told no, again, that's going to impact your business because you're not going to be able to generate enough income, assumingly, to continue a viable business. There are so many areas that it interacts in terms of your personal and business life. And of course, quite easily, you know, planning, organization, where we're thinking about managing your money on a day-to-day basis. On the more kind of obvious side, shutdowns and meltdowns. So those who are autistic or have ADHD may completely shut down for days or weeks. And if you think about just, you know, what's required when it comes to money management, if you're shutting down and not doing anything, that's going to impact your finances for sure. You know, if you're overwhelmed and overstimulated and you're just shutting off from the world, you're going to feel the consequences in your bank account. So yeah, it can really interact quite a lot with your finances. And just looping back to what we spoke about earlier, it's not all doom and gloom. I work with a lot of neurodiverse individuals, and it's about becoming aware of that, kind of getting brave to dive into that space and be like, okay, what am I doing? When am I doing it? Why am I doing it? Okay, how can I put things in place to help me be better in those areas? And you know, it wasn't the question, but there are obviously lots of benefits of being a neurodiverse or neurospicy individual as well.
Thank you for that, because I think, again, there is so much information out there, but you've summarized it so well, and also just reminded people that it doesn't have to be an impediment, but it is important that we, if you feel that you are noticing certain things, or perhaps you've been noticing since you were a teenager or a young woman, and now you're a bit older and you have the means perhaps to go and get that independent assessment, then it might be worthwhile doing so. So yeah, super helpful, Crystal. So now just changing tack slightly and thinking about, you know, some of the moments of truth in our lives that all of us will experience in different ways. You know, we don't necessarily all experience the same milestones, but we are certainly achieving certain milestones or going through overcoming certain hurdles as individuals, which will also, you know, the pinch points in our lives that will also intersect with our money and then our mental well-being. And you shared a popular reel recently about the competitive streak among moms in the playground. Can you share, for anyone that hasn't seen that, can you share what that was about and why do you think it resonated with so many of us? Because I think when we think about those moments of truth for us on our financial journeys, becoming a mom, I mean, there are so many others and I want us to talk about them in a minute, but motherhood, particularly, of course, you know, among the Rainmaker community, there are lots of moms. There are lots of women that have caring responsibilities for children, whether nieces, nephews, you know, and what have you. And it can lead to some really crazy behavior. Becoming a mom, you think of yourself as one way, and then as soon as those children come along, you are somebody else. And that can feel, you know, like really overstimulating, discombobulating. You talked about emotional dysregulation as well. And so you can find yourself exhibiting certain behaviors that might otherwise appear or seem alien to you. So can you share with us, first of all, that reel and why you think it resonated with so many of us?
Yeah, for sure. I think those are two reels, I think. And it was a podcast I did with Tolu, who talks about parenting and kind of looking after her boys. And it was talking about being at the school gate when you're dropping off the kids. I'm not a parent, but I see all the parents. And the comparison to, you know, what the other child is wearing or what they're doing for their birthday party and how, you know, flamboyant that's going to be. So it's just purely the comparison between you as a mother and this other mother and what you're doing for your child. And I can't remember exactly what she said, but it just really seemed to resonate with people and quite a few comments and views. And I think in terms of why it resonated, one is what we've touched on a few points here, and I think it's a really big factor, is the whole social comparison and status seeking, right? And you as a parent, you want to look like you're a good parent. You want to look like you're doing good for your child, for the child to feel like you're doing good, for starters, and also for the, you know, in front of the other parents. So that, of course, is going to influence what you spend your money on, what you do for your child's party, you know, what trainers you buy them, what trip you send them on. And you want to be seen as though you are investing in your children. And the other is, you mentioned it just now, I think, but it's the whole, from what I understand, identity shift. Especially if you're a first-time mom, it's, you're new to this game, and surely you want to feel accepted or feel like you're doing it well. So you're going to lean into those, what seem like indicators to show that you are doing well as a new parent. And finally, again, we're social creatures, right? We want to fit in. We want to be part of a community. We want to belong. And like with any kind of community, not just being a mum, to do that, you usually have to be doing things like the rest of the group. You know, I talk about this a lot when I talk about young people or just us, anyone in general. The people you are around, your community, your friends, your peers, you are part of that community because you guys are similar in some way. I sometimes touch on this when I talk about wanting to make change or change your life to be a certain way. You have to change your circle often. But here, of course, if you're a parent or a mum and you are now, ideally, you want to be part of the mum community, right? You don't want to be isolated. So that might mean you do things like they do, which might mean spend so much more on certain things for your child. So I think there's some of the reasons why it's such a really important point, you know, just back to what we said earlier, something to be really aware of. Okay, what's driving me here? Why am I doing these things?
I love that. And I can completely relate to everything that you said. I mean, obviously the Rainmakers will know, and probably anybody listening at this stage will know, that I've got two daughters. And for me, that identity shift into motherhood, I'm now about to be 10 years in, which is wild. But still, it takes a long time for you to come back to yourself. And then I suppose, do you come back to the person that you were before, or have you had to reinvent yourself? And I think for lots of women, you might have quite liked the person that you were before. So now to find yourself, you know, cast adrift from who that person was, and you're trying to find your way back to her. And then you've got all the twists and turns along the way and all of the other external stimuli to contend with as well. You can definitely find yourself entering into certain things and certain competitions that you would have otherwise viewed as completely trivial. And so, for example, the birthday party is a brilliant example because it's one that I'm in the midst of right now. And it's interesting to me that from my experience, certainly the girl's dad, he is completely immune to this level of competition. You don't have, from what I can gather, and I've got lots of friends that are dads, I don't see them entering into the same level of competition or putting the same amount of pressure on themselves to meet the expectations. And sometimes you think, are they the expectations of children or are they the expectations of other people that we have to be seen to be doing certain things, that because we have these kinds of jobs or we are these kinds of people, we should have this kind of party because the party becomes an emblem of your financial success or the extracurricular activities that you sign your kids up to. Well, if that child is doing cello, then my child's got to do violin, or my child's got to do violin and piano and tennis and swimming and everything else in between. And of course, there is a financial cost associated with that. So people are literally stretching themselves. And if you've got one or two or three or four children, how are you financing that? So suddenly the competition comes with not just an emotional and a mental cost, there is the financial cost that's associated as well. And exactly to your point, it's the same as anything that we might do as rainmakers, whether you're a mom or not, being super clear with yourself as to why am I doing this? Is this the path that I really want to pursue? Do I really want to get to MD at the bank? Or am I just thinking that I should do that because that's what my peer group are doing? And it's part of our social contract that we keep up with one another. Otherwise, what am I going to talk about? I'm going to feel completely irrelevant in this group. But then you find yourself unhappy in the pursuit of that MD position. As soon as you get it, you realize, okay, well, I've got it now. And it feels like a massive anticlimax because I'm just not that excited, or I've got the money and I've bought all the things, but there's only so much that I can buy. What else am I supposed to do with this title and with all this money? So it really, again, is important that we come back to what is driving our decision-making, what matters to us, because the strain on our mental well-being is incalculable. And so that is a classic example. But I'd be really interested to hear from any of the dads, if there are any dads listening, or for any of the moms listening, just let me know, does your partner, does your children's father share the same, you know, does he withstand the same level of pressure that you are carrying when it comes to some of these things, the parties and the extracurricular activities that you know deep down you're feeling you've got to push yourself for because you've got to keep up with everybody else? Just let me know. Email me, DM, send a smoke signal. Just let me know what's going on with the dads because I'm very interested in this. I do very strongly. My hunch tells me that women are far more likely to be impacted by this and feel they've got to keep up with the Joneses than our male counterparts in the parenting arena, for sure.
Yeah, I've seen men do it as well. I do. I see men struggle with it, I think. But yeah, on the mother, the women's side, I think there's that part of you're the nurturer. You need to protect, care, show that you are highly invested in your child. So maybe it's a bit stronger. I wonder if there's a piece of research specifically on that.
Well, I'm glad to know that there are some dads that are in the ring with us as well, acting crazy. So I suppose linked to that then, other moments of truth, because we know that it's not just motherhood. There are so many other experiences that we go through as we traverse life. There are lots more women that are living alone now, for example. And of course, that comes with, again, its own financial opportunities as well as challenges. So it might be that you live alone. It could be that you are cohabiting with a partner. You are cohabiting with housemates or flatmates. How does that impact, you know, your relationship with money and some of the financial decisions that you take? What are some of the other moments of truth or milestones in our life, would you say, at which our relationship with money, our actions and activities up until that point, suddenly it's like having to confront yourself for better or worse and realizing, oh, no, I'm on the right path. I'm doing some really positive things here. I just need a tweak here or there. Or actually, gosh, this is a hot mess and I really need to do something about it. But it's only by virtue of me being in this situation. It could be that you're about to get married. It could be you're going through a divorce. You know, there are so many different things like that that suddenly force you to confront your finances. What would you say? What would you say are some of the big ones for you, the big milestones at which we need to start taking our financial well-being seriously in particular?
It's interesting. I think one that's been in conversation recently with a couple of my clients is their parents moving away. So again, depends on the age, but if your parent is moving say, back to the Caribbean, for example, and now you maybe have a property to be responsible for, or but something's changing in your finances, that can really get you to be like, oh, now it's just me, time to be serious, and having to figure out, how am I going to navigate this world? I think I was talking on a panel and a young woman was talking about the same thing. I think her and her sister's mother was moving away and they now had to figure out, well, what are they going to do? Are they going to buy property together? And instantly they have to get serious. You know, I think one of them had a full-time job, one had a small side hustle, wasn't really making, you know, and they had to start thinking, okay, now I need to really focus on my finances. And I think the main, like the question, the main part of this is some kind of change in your life. When something's changing, it's of course going to impact your finances. And I think you just touched on moving in with someone, you know, you're dating, you get to the stage where you want to live together. Now you may need to expose your finances, you know, and share what's happening in your pocket. How much money do you make, or how much can you contribute to rent or a mortgage? Or if you're going through the home buying process, obviously,
I think that's a really big one.
you have to expose it's a huge one. Everything. Right. And now it's, you know, obviously I've done many mortgages myself and I hate the process because I've got exposed to a stranger, whereas, you know, I'm quite private with my money. But to do that with somebody is a double whammy, and that will force you to look at yourself. Okay, I am here because of the decisions I made up until this point. That's really exposing, and it can be quite vulnerable to go through. And I'm saying that, and I'm sure you've raised this question to inspire people to actually do the work, to look at themselves and their finances before they get to that point. So when they do get there, they're like, yeah, let's go. And I mean, there's many others, you know, an accident or some kind of illness that takes you out of work. If you don't have, you know, the right protections in place to see you through that difficult time, which is very common, or, you know, death in the family. And now you've got all these bills to pay to cover that person no longer being here, even if it's just the funeral alone. If you haven't prepared for things like that, it can be really stressful on top of the stress of the situation itself. And that can really dent your mental health. The main point here would, of course, be prepare for those moments and put as much in place as you can to help you through those difficult times.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you for sharing that. So many useful insights, I think. And I think what's important to share is that whether your milestone is identical to someone else's or not, there is definitely somebody else that will have had those experiences. So we should never feel that we are uniquely, yes, it's unique to us, but that there will be others that will have had similar experiences. And so there will be somebody that you can reach out to. And this is where social media can be quite powerful. There will be those people that are willing to share quite candidly their own experiences and how they've managed to navigate them. And I think that can be quite comforting as well for us in overcoming, particularly, as you say, when it comes to, for the first time, having to, I don't know, talk to your partner about some of the financial decisions that you've taken up to that point. And, you know, thinking, oh God, is it going to change the way that they view me? And often, you know, being able to hear from other people who've been in that situation as to how they've managed it, that can be quite helpful and quite a powerful first step in feeling in control of the situation. So, okay, so Crystal, for this final part of the episode, I always like to talk to people about their personal relationship with money. And you've just said that you are very private about your money.
I'm private about the numbers, but I'm happy to talk about money.
Good. I like that distinction. You know what? Somebody asked me the other day, and I get this question quite often. And for somebody that spends a lot of time talking about money, I'm very similar to you. I am open about what it takes to build a solid financial foundation. Absolutely. You know, I think it's important that we all know those principles. But I always balk at people out of the blue, however close to me they are, just randomly asking me for the specific numbers, because I find that that's particularly invasive for me. And so I'm glad you shared that just now, because I say that to say, for anyone listening that feels like, oh my God, like, am I supposed to be going into the office and telling everybody that this is the exact amount of money that I earn and this is the exact bonus that I earned? You shouldn't have to feel that you need to do that. It's more about an openness to the conversation around money, but you should not ever feel you have to divulge anything personal about yourself, even if it's to your bestie. Doesn't matter who it's to at all. Don't feel that if somebody randomly ambushes you and starts asking you about how much money do you make, Dav, each month, where does that money come from? that you have to answer those questions. So that's a reminder to myself and a reminder to anybody listening as well that might be thinking that in this now much more open dialogue we are having about money, that you should feel that you have to do things that you are uncomfortable with, I should say.
Just on that, I think especially as well, the fact that we understand that people make assumptions and instantly have a bio about you based on how much money is in your bank account or,
correct.
You know, and especially as us in the financial education space, they'd assume that you have to have a certain setup for you to be qualified to educate and train. And I don't think that's the case. It's more that you've done the right things to get yourself to whatever point and you can support others with that.
And I think those projections, actually, it's a really good point. Again, those projections, particularly given everything that we've talked about in this episode around the money scripts, how we are influenced by the projections placed on our shoulders by other people, feeling that we've got to present a certain way. I've had people say to me, you know, oh, do you have to work? You know, if you know how to build wealth, then you shouldn't be working. And I'm like, well, first of all, I love this work. That was the whole point of me setting up my own business, so that I could do the work that I really wanted to do.
Yeah.
And even for those people that decide they want to retire early, they're still working on things because they want their brains to be actively engaged all the time. But they just want to pursue things that light them up, that make them feel excited to come into work every day. That's the first thing. But the second thing, I've got two kids. We've just talked about the birthday parties and what they cost. Like, what the hell? Why do you think that I don't work?
Yeah.
You know, I have taken certain decisions in my life to place myself in the environment in which I and my daughters can thrive.
Mm.
That doesn't mean that I don't have to work. And it certainly doesn't mean that I don't need money.
Mm.
Just for the record. Okay, Crystal, over to you. Back over to you.
Yeah.
I mean, let's talk about your personal relationship with money and how would you say it's evolved over time?
I think going right back, money was not conversation at home. The only thing that I knew about money was that it was hard to come by and there wasn't much of it. Single parent home, mum was self-employed. So she's in the hair and beauty industry and has done since she was 16. So I learned from early on about entrepreneurship, but not in the way that you might learn if you were Richard Branson's child. It was more, you know, mum went off to work, it was just work, and there wasn't much of it. So that meant I grew up as a hoarder with a scarcity mindset. It has its pros and cons, right? On the pro side, I was good in terms of I saved, I acquired and built enough of a pot to be able to buy my first property in my early 20s. And be quite smart and savvy with it. But on the other side, I'm sure I could have done other things with that money if I had learned about money from earlier on. Yeah, as time's gone on, of course, I've learned about money, learned about leverage, learned how to invest and capitalize on what I have. So it's definitely been a journey. But pre-21, I think it was 21 or 20 when me and a guy that I was dating were deciding on, actually, should we move in together? It was like, yeah, sure. And I was like, right, let's do a budget. Let's see how long it will take us to save our deposit. So I created this personal budget on Excel. And that's when, I can't remember how much I was taking home, I should check, but I couldn't identify £500 worth of spend and now in 1 month. And I was like, and I'm sure my take home was less than £2,000. I'm like, that's a lot of money to not be able to see where it went. I have nothing to show for it. So from the age of 20 to now, I've been using that same tool, which has obviously evolved over time, to track and really be on top of my finances. But yeah, before that date, I'd never looked at my money in such a way at all. And just an update on that story, we'd not rent a property together. Instead, I went on, bought a property by myself.
I love that, Crystal. And again, highlighting in, you know, your real life experience of one of those moments of truth where suddenly you're having to be like, let me look at the numbers and realizing they don't tally. So yeah, we all have that. I mean, I've shared before about, for me, it being when I bought my first flat, and prior to that, never at all being completely footloose and fancy free when it came to my money, always having enough to spend on what I needed to spend, never going into my overdraft, and then suddenly having a mortgage and being like, why am I in overdraft? What's happening? And then from that point, that was really what helped me start my own foundation around, Dav, you've got to be better with your numbers. You've got to know what's going on. It can't be a free-for-all. So yeah. Okay. So against that backdrop then, and given what we've talked about with regard to where we are, how we are socialized when it comes to our money management and what we learn in the home. So you came from a very entrepreneurial home and learned to save, of course. But what does it mean to be a wealthy woman to you now? What does wealth mean to you in all of the different ways that it might show up?
I think in simple terms, it's having the mental freedom to live without strain. So I say that in comparison to how I grew up. Money was always a strain and everything was restricted. Like I remember not wanting to come home and say, hey, there's a school trip. You know, I was reluctant to say those things. So now I think when we think about wealthy woman I think about freedom, and that goes back to me being very aware about the kind of life I want to have, what I want to do, what brings me joy, what I value. We didn't touch on value much. Like, there was a point I wanted to mention, but yeah, what I value, what I want my world to be like, which is going to be very different to you, to the next man or woman, which is absolutely fine. And as long as I am able to live in my value and have a life aligned with what truly excites me. And remember a word my therapist introduced to me, which was vitality. As long as I've got that in my life, that's what's going to keep me happy, at peace, and able to give to others as best I can. And so wealth is being able to do all of that. And that, for me, comes from planning and being very self-aware and clear about what I need.
I love that, Crystal. I feel like that's a perfect way for us to conclude today's episode. We started with a conversation about financial empathy, which, as I say, really resonated with me. And now we're ending with the idea of mental freedom and living without strain, which I think is something that we can all get behind in terms of, you know, our ambitions. But it's so important that we are clear on our own values and making sure that we are doing things that are in alignment with those values. We will always feel dysregulated, unregulated, if we are going against those values, and it will show up for us in our bodies. So, you know, this week, as I say, at the time of recording, it is Mental Health Awareness Week. And so it's important that we all just pay attention a bit more and start to notice. Crystal, any final comments from you?
I think it would just be to be gentle with yourself. When people come to me looking for money, support, their personal business, they are feeling quite bad about themselves and feeling that they're not good enough. And, you know, I can get quite aggressive and knock that out of you because it's not necessary. We're all beautiful. We're all unique. We're all on our own life journey. And I guess if no one's heard of the term neuroplasticity, that might be quite exciting to some people who feel like they're stuck in their financial habits. We can all grow, change, and become whatever we desire if we just go through the process, which is exciting.
It is exciting. So, Crystal, how can people get in contact with you, follow you, or find out more about working with Mind Over Money?
Thank you. Either search my name, Crystal McGilvery. I'm sure you're going to pop all the letters somewhere, spelled slightly different. Or check out the website. We are Mind Over Money. I exist on many socials, Instagram, LinkedIn. And yeah, just ping me a message. I'm very open, very chatty. We can either work together on your personal business finances or do group training around financial confidence.
Thank you so much, Crystal. We appreciate you for being here today. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hi everyone, Davinia here. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode. If any of what you heard resonated and you'd like to find out more about how Raincheck is helping women all over the world build sustainable long-term wealth, then visit our website at raincheck.com and join the mailing list for more commentary, tips, and opinion on how you can start taking steps to leveling up your financial well-being today. You can follow us on social media at Raincheck, and don't forget to share, like, rate, review, and subscribe. See you next time.